Coming up today, Roland meets one of the most powerful people in the technology industry, Jeremy gets a glimpse at the future of tractors, and Vicky gets excited about tunnels. You're listening to episode 312 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me today are Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
Jeremy White.
Hello.
And Vicky Wollaston.
Hello.
A thing you learned this week. Roland, we'll start with you.
So I found out how many tech events there are in London. Would you like to guess?
No, I really wouldn't.
No, you love it when there's a guessing
3,000. 3,000. Every day.
3,000 every day. No, go on. Have a guess for the year. For the year 2016. You can also guess, because I have the number, the number of people who went to them.
I reckon there were 712 events attended by, on average, like 100 people an event.
Okay.
I think there's probably more, because I get invitations to a lot of them. 1,203 and 100 people going to each one.
Okay. Jeremy, I know, I mean, you really know tech events.
I would say, I mean, what you're talking about as a tech event, are you talking about a product? Are you talking about actually like a seminar or talks? Or are you talking about the launch of a product, or is everything included in tech events?
Be more specific.
I think it's everything.
I would say 2,500. No, that seems too big.
I reckon you got a 2,500 a year just yourself.
And the answer is?
Well, the answer is, according to this company, Airfinity, 10,000. And there were 800,000 people went to them. This is in 2016.
Whoa.
And the average event has 84 attendees.
Okay, so we were close on the average number of attendees, just all quite far off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. I mean, it feels like there are a lot.
And there
are. Really are. There we go.
Vicky, what did you learn this week?
I learned this week that your bones make up about 15% of your total body weight. So if you weigh 100 pounds, your bones weigh about 15 pounds. But I also learned that 25% of those bones are in your feet.
Cool. Been digging up any skeletons this week, Vicky? I learned that in the United States, it typically takes between 12 and 17 days for a lettuce to make it from a farm to your table. There you go. Fresh salad. There's nothing to add.
I have a follow-up thing to
that. Oh, go on.
If you chop up a lettuce with a plastic knife, it lasts longer. If you chop it with metal, there's something in the metal that makes it go rotten quicker.
So if you want to keep your 17-day-old lettuce fresher for longer...
Yes.
Use plastic knives.
There you go.
Jeremy, what did you learn this week?
Okay, I have two things that I learned this week. One is Wired and one is patently not. Which one do you want first?
Let's go for Wired first.
Wired first. Okay, quantum computing. Big thing coming the next couple of years, hopefully. Now, what most people don't realise is that quantum computers have actually been around for absolutely decades. In fact, atomic clocks are quantum computers. But the thing is, they're so accurate, quantum computers, or atomic clocks are so accurate. If you took the most accurate atomic clock in existence today and started it at the Big Bang, it would still be within a second's accuracy today.
That is pretty cool.
Better than my alarm clock at home.
Only a little, but yes. Definitely. So from the Big Bang to right now, it would only be 1 second out. Now, anybody with a proper mechanical watch, they'll lose about 2 minutes a day. So that shows you how ridiculously accurate atomic clocks are.
So that's very wired.
That's very wired. The other thing I learnt today was that you can make your own cream eggs. This is an Easter fact for you.
Your eyes have lit up with excitement.
See, atomic clocks, they can go hang. I want to know how to make your own cream eggs. Basically, I always thought it was a far too complex process to actually make at home. I watched a video this morning on Twitter showing you from a major UK supermarket, showing you how to do this. And I thought, normally don't take any notice of those promotions whatsoever on Twitter. But this one, I actually watched the entire video, and I'm going to do it this weekend. I'm going to do a dry run because you can make them big. You can make a giant cream egg.
Oh, please,
I mean, who wouldn't want that?
Yep, yep.
Bring one in.
At least take some pictures and some videos and put them on Twitter. Yeah, well, definitely that. But for the benefit
the
of those on the podcast.
With a cream egg the size of his head.
That's it. My work is done here. I'm off.
Excellent.
I can't do any better than that.
Oh, yeah. Mic drop. Impressive.
Well, we can't drop the mic. They're on stands. Our first story. Roland. Well, actually, we should say before that, get well soon, Matt Burgess.
He's
at home rather ill. Otherwise, he would be here. I know he'll listen. So feel better, and we'll see you again when you're less ill next week. First story. Roland, a few months ago now, you spent rather a lot of time with Margaret Vestager. Why?
Well, she is the European Competition Commissioner, and that makes her one of the most powerful people in tech, definitely in Europe, and maybe in the whole world. So you may remember a little while ago now that Apple was asked to pay back 13 billion euros in tax. That was her. She asked them to pay that back.
Well, she didn't ask them, she told them.
Well, she told them, yeah.
Pretty punchy.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And she is kind of judge and jury in these cases. So she investigates and then she decides. And then, yeah, there's an appeal process ongoing, but effectively they have to do it. And right now, Apple are working out the way to give the Irish government back this money, and they're holding it in an escrow.
With interest.
With interest, it's important to note. And they're holding it in an escrow account while the appeal process goes on. So that was her.
So she's the person that has oversight of all competition policy within the European Union, and it's her job to enforce the rules set out within the member bloc.
Exactly. And so the Apple case was the really high-profile one, but an even bigger case is coming up, and this is this case that's been rumbling on for 7 years about Google. It's the antitrust case against Google, essentially accusing Google of being a monopoly and of using its monopoly power to suppress smaller companies. And she came in 2014 and really has pushed this forward since then. And a lot of people expect that her judgment will be coming soon. And a lot of people expect that it will be pretty tough. Mm-hmm. And this could actually change the way that Google looks within Europe, really fundamentally changed the way that Google operates. I mean, it's important stuff.
So let's frame this around. It's the new issue of the magazine, which is out now, the May edition. A big, striking red cover. Google, Apple, Amazon, who's next? Europe's $35 billion pound war on Silicon Valley. Tussle with Silicon Valley.
Yeah, I think it's more of a war with Silicon Valley than a war on Silicon Valley.
Yeah, there's definitely an argument going on. And while the Apple case was particularly striking because of the large number involved, even though that's pocket change to Apple.
Exactly. Well, I mean, yeah, pretty, you know, it'll make a difference. Yeah, and, you know, the biggest tax penalty ever. But yeah, there's so much more going on here than just these big fines. So
with the Google case, and there was a Microsoft case a little while ago where Microsoft was fined quite a substantial amount of money, and its shares actually went up because it was less than 1% of the cash that it held in reserve. So people are like, oh, well, that's fine. But the actual damage that was done to Microsoft were in the changes that the European Union forced it to make. And this could be the same for Google.
Exactly. So in that case, it's a really good example. In that case, this is all about Internet Explorer. And Microsoft had it as the default on its Windows operating system. The European Commission obliged it to have some other alternatives. And a couple of years later, no one used Internet Explorer. There are other reasons for that, partly because it's crap.
You said it.
Yeah, I thought. But the fact that the European Commission obliged Microsoft to bring up other options really, really, really changed the way they operated. And ironically, the big winner from that was Google. Chrome is now an incredibly powerful browser, giving Google all that data. And now Google is facing the same thing. And the particular case that that Vestager is looking at is around shopping. So, you know, if you Google a product,
which people do all the time, Jeremy, you probably do it more than most.
It's my entire life.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, and you see that little shopping tab at the top. Well, what is alleged is that Google uses that to promote products, particular products, and suppress rival search engines that might come up with different answers. That's just the shopping case. say, I mean, this once if that's been established, then this would be a precedent for everything. Think about maps. Right now, when you Google a postcode, you get the Google map. That's an incredible advantage to Google. But if this case goes forward, then you might get an option of different maps. And I mean, so there's a and there's a case in the UK High Court at the moment around StreetMap, who feel unfairly dealt with by Google. They feel like they had a good product, and then Google basically suppressed them by using their search power. I mean, you know, we might see a whole bunch of different map options. You might see the revival of StreetMap.
This Maybe. Could really change Bing Maps. But yeah, there was a particularly exactly, good yeah. example that Vestaya gave you that was around when you search for a flight online. So yeah. when I search to get from A to B on the ground in the UK, probably do it through Google Maps. Google tells me the answer. Google gets all that data on where I want to go. When I'm looking to fly somewhere, I might use Skyscanner. Skyscanner gives you options from all of the different flight companies. It still gets that data on where you're looking to go and can tailor advertising relevant to you, but it's offering you a portal by which to then book with other providers. Google is different in that it would be a bit like saying BA is Google Maps and something like Skyscanner is a more open system. And that's kind of what she's looking to change.
That's her vision, yeah. And I think what's unusual about her, she's a fascinating person to meet. It was really interesting to spend time with her. What's unusual about her is that she just comes out straight out and says it. She says, this is not right. This is unacceptable. And she's a really clear voice on this issue. I think a lot of politicians, they get confused or they're not quite sure what they really want to see. She says, no, we should have choice. She says, it's a problem that I don't have choice right now. When I get in somewhere, I've flown in. And then when I open an app, I can just open Uber. She says, that's wrong. I don't want to see that. And that's her vision, and she has the power to enforce it. So it's significant stuff.
But let's get a bit more into her as a personality, because there's an awful lot of unknowns here. We won't possibly know what the outcome of the Google case is for a few more months yet.
Yep.
But we wanted to be early with this feature, just in case it came out quickly. So an awful lot of it is getting to know Margaret Vestager, and she's a fascinating human being.
Yeah, she really is. So so she's Danish. She grew up in... The kind of rural part of Denmark, and both her her dad was a pastor, so she's kind of comes from quite a strong religious background, and you can see in a lot of the way she talks about stuff and a lot of the way she deals with things, there's a real moral element, and she became one of the most her parents were also local politicians, and she followed them into this small party. I mean, if you imagine it in the UK context, it's basically like the Lib Dems of the of Denmark. And she actually, but she ended up becoming one of the most powerful politicians in Denmark. And if you've seen the TV show Born, as I now know it's pronounced, that was the writers actually based a lot of the material on that on her. So she's kind of that character. Yeah, and so you know, so in that the woman in charge of the smaller party out negotiates the men and ends up becoming one of the most powerful people in the country. With Vestager's case, she was actually deputy prime minister in the show. They made her the prime minister. But anyway, yeah, they based that on her, and then she became European Commissioner a couple of years ago, and I think what's really noticeable about her when you meet her is that she is really paying attention to you, like she actually focuses on you. That's her job. It's kind of a charm effort. But say, like, I'd heard beforehand that she was very elaborate in the way that she set up meetings. But I wasn't quite sure what to expect. So what happened was that I was taken up into the giant, kind of quite sort of dirty, big European building in the European Commission headquarters. And they put me in a waiting room. And I kind of sat there for a while, like 10 minutes, kind of wondering what was happening. And then the door of the waiting room opened and she came to meet me. And this was all part of it, so that she would come to the waiting room and then she takes you into her office, so that she's leading you in there. She's showing that she's a personality more than just a bureaucrat or an enforcer. And then inside her office, it's so colourful. There's things all over the place. There's little symbols, little items. So, for example, so she's got a wooden ladder that she has next to her desk. And that is to symbolise the fact that if you're a woman in politics, you need to bring your own ladder.
And that's how she actually put it.
Exactly. Yeah. And then she's got a plaster cast of a life-size plaster cast of a hand kind of giving the middle finger. And this was a gift from a a trade union that she got when she was having a big conflict in Denmark about cutting unemployment benefits, which she pushed through. And this guy gave her this gift. And what she says that symbolizes is that you can't get on with everyone. You know, you can't make everyone happy. And in the piece, I use that to symbolize the one thing that really struck me about her was that she will not back down.
Yeah,
and she won't be pushed around.
And there's an interesting bit that you didn't get from her, but from someone else that was familiar with the meetings that she had with Tim Cook after she announced this record.
Before. Yeah.
And he allegedly shouted at her. He was very confrontational and wanted to lecture her on his views about tax policy.
Yeah.
And if Tim Cook, one of the most, probably the most significant tech CEO in the United States, can't get you to back down, then you're
also,
probably fairly...
he's one of the... when you see him talk, he's really calm and serene and he's really considered. I can't even imagine him shouting at anyone. So that just goes to show how much it's rattled him.
Well, yeah, but although apparently Tim Cook likes... he goes with that style occasionally. So when the rumours about this were coming up, Tim Cook flew to Brussels and went into her office and apparently, I mean, I've been told by people familiar with the meeting that he really went for it. He shouted at her, he lectured her, he told her that she didn't understand what was going on, and well, you saw the result. I mean, it didn't face her at all, and it wouldn't. I opened the whole piece. The first line of the piece is, "Margrethe Vestager doesn't like being told what to do." And I think this is true of her personally, in that she wouldn't like it if you went in there and tried to push her around. But also, she doesn't like the way that, as she sees it, technology companies are always trying to influence her, kind of get in her. You know, like lead her places, push things on her. So, and it was fascinating to talk about her use of technology. So, for example, we were talking about Google, and I said, "Well, yeah, but you use Google, don't you?" She's like, "Yes, I do, but I also use alternatives. I use Bing, I use DuckDuckGo." She told me that she had the location tracker on her phone turned off because she didn't want to be told where to go. She wants to work it out for herself, and this is, I think, key to her whole approach and her way of doing things, that she doesn't want to be told. She wants to make the decision herself, even if it's wrong. And that, for her, is what being... I don't want to sound kind of really, you know, highfalutin about this, but her political philosophy is that that's what being an adult and a human is about, that you make your own decisions. Sometimes you get it wrong, you learn, and you move on. And there isn't this magic AI that tells you the answer and then that in a way that knows the answer better than you know it, so which is kind of the tech philosophy.
Let's bring it back down to earth very briefly before we wrap this story up. And everyone should go and read it. It's in the magazine. It will be online in a few weeks. The counter argument to that is that it's the European Union using its position of power to punish American companies and to try and give other European companies a leg up. That's been the argument. I mean, even Barack Obama spoke very, very strongly against the way the European Commission was acting against big American technology companies. So there's this, as we refer to it on the cover, a war on, but there's this real ideological difference. America sees it as Europe having its own objectives and points of view, and by the sounds of it, Versailles just sees it as, well, no, this is how things should be.
Yeah. And she says, so I asked her about this, and she just says, well, they've got a different approach in America. They're much more commercial. They feel less strongly about public space than we do. And in Europe, we have a different approach. But I think, I mean, you know, this really is really fundamental to everything that's going on in tech right now. And just, I mean, so we talked a lot about Facebook when in the interview and in my meetings with her. And if you think about, say, like the issue of fake news and how the Germans are dealing with it and how in Europe they're dealing with it by passing laws to force Google and Facebook to take down fake news and really try and restrict the big tech companies, this is a totally different approach to the one they're taking in the US. And I mean, it's not necessarily my role in these interviews to try and judge her. My role is to kind of try and present her views and make sure I've questioned her. But... you know, I mean, she puts forward a very, very clear case for why the tech companies have got this wrong and why they need regulating.
And regardless of your view, to those that hold the opinion that bureaucrats in Brussels don't do anything, take a look at Margrethe Vestager. and read Roland's article. It's brilliant. Our second story this week is a somewhat rapid departure to the world of tunnels. Vicky, yesterday you spent all day in one.
So I think I love tunnels more than I love batteries.
And that's saying something.
Whoa.
And if anyone who knows me knows that that's serious. So yeah, so I went down to Stepney Green tunnels yesterday at Crossrail. And then got to have a look around the new Tottenham Court Road, Elizabeth Line, platform, ticket hall.
So for those not in the UK or in London and not au fait with tunnels, what is Crossrail? What is the Elizabeth Line?
So the Crossrail programme has been set up and the Elizabeth Line will run from Reading and Heathrow in the west through 26 miles of new tunnels under central London to Shenfield and Abbey Wood in the east. It's basically meant to be a much easier way for people to commute into London, to get across the city a lot quicker and from these areas that I mentioned.
This is the biggest major infrastructure project in the world or Europe or was at a time.
So it's cost about 14.8 billion. It's about 80% complete at the moment, and they assure me that it's on time and on budget. So if that carries on, they are due to open, or the first lines are due to start running December 2018.
And it's going to make a huge difference. Well, there'll be an awful lot less building work going on around London because at the moment there's holes all over the place where they're putting in these new stations and ducts and stuff.
Well, even outside the wired office, the whole of the square that's outside our office is completely taken over as a building site. So you can't even see the grass anymore. You can't see anything.
So it was very interesting for you to go down in the tunnels. And over the last couple of years, I think various people from Wired have been down there and gotten access. But now, as you say, it's 80% complete. So it almost looks like what it will look like when it opens in a few months.
Well, so I went down with a photographer called Christopher Woodquist, and he went down there, Stepney Green again, went down there in 2013 and took photos of just these massive holes in the ground. Mm-hmm. Just complete full circles. Now when you go down there, these circles have got all the cabling in there, they've got the sleepers, the tracks, they're working on it. The Stepney Green is really interesting because you can see the way the tunnel curves around to Whitechapel. There is something, I know you all take the mickey out of me for loving tunnels, but there is something quite beautiful about these huge concrete structures. And then Tottenham Court Road was great as well, because Stepney Green's obviously slightly further out, so it's going to look slightly different, and the way that it works is slightly different. Tottenham Court Road is going to be this massive hub. It's going to be added to the station that there is at the moment, so there's going to be a Northern Line, a Central Line, an Elizabeth Line all crossing through this one station. And what's so great about it is they've got these escalators which look like something out of a sci-fi film. Christopher took one picture of one of the tunnels, and so the cladding's on one side but not on the other, and it looks just like the Millennium Falcon, and I don't say that lightly, it really does. It's really sci-fi down there. And it's just fascinating to see from when Christopher went there the first time in 2013 to what it's like now, and then we're hoping to go back in there once they hand over the keys to TfL for testing to go and have another look at it.
What's really interesting, and when people see the pictures, they'll get a sense of it, is when you go to these spaces that you're used to seeing full of people, and they're designed to be full of people and machinery and advertising and shops, and there's no one there. It's a bit like if you get a train very early in the morning or a really early morning flight, and King's Cross Station or Paris Garden Or is just completely empty. And here, it's not just completely empty of people, it's completely empty of all of the furnishings that you'd be used to seeing it with. So it's really eerie.
It's really creepy. Really, really creepy. When you're right down in the tunnels of Stepney Green, there is something that's quite... It's really dry down there. It's freezing cold. There is something, to continue the sci-fi reference, there's something really sci-fi about these tunnels.
It's also the size of the tunnels as well, isn't it? I mean, when you don't have that furniture, when you don't have the trains in there or the platform, and you actually see how large these tunnels have to be. I mean, and also what's fascinating, it's the human endeavour. It's like, you know, look what we can do right there in front of you. It's almost impossible to believe that it can be done, and in such a short space of time.
Well, what I thought was quite interesting is so much of this programme in particular, it may be why it's on budget, is that a lot of the machines are automated.
Oh, really?
So when you go to TCR, you can actually go underneath one of the platforms at the moment. It won't obviously be open when the station opens, but you can go down there and you can see all the cabling and all of the stuff that's under there. That wouldn't have been there when the first underground network was put down, because the first underground network was at a point where tunnelling itself in that sort of capacity was pioneering. Now we've ticked that off and we're going to the next level. So their gantries and their drilling rigs and their concrete machines, they're just... Has anyone seen the film Labyrinth?
Yes.
You know when Jareth sends in the cleaners?
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yep.
That it reminds me of that, the way that it drills through. Obviously, it's a lot more technical than that. But so they'll create a ring, and then they'll drop concrete in there, and then they'll create another ring, and they'll drop concrete in there, and the mud and all the silt and everything gets pulled away in a separate place. Then at the back of this huge, great, big, long machine, they lay the sleepers and the concrete, and then another end of the machine brings through the tracks. So you've got this one machine being able to do these huge, huge tunnels. And the platforms at Tottenham Court Road are going to be 234 metres long, and they sit 24 metres below the ground, which is about five stories, which is really significant. But when I was in Stepney Green, I could still get phone signal. So it just goes to show how they're weaving in and out of London, which I thought was really interesting as well.
Where does the line go? Remind me. It goes like east to west, doesn't it?
So it goes from Reading and Heathrow in the west, 26 miles across central London, to Shenfield and Abbeywood in the east.
And then because it stopped like Bond Street, Farringdon, Tottenham Court Road, yeah. Well, it's going to change things massively, isn't it?
I might just take a trip to Reading just for lols on the Elizabeth line.
I think quite a lot of people will on the. It will be very, very, very busy on the first day with people just going for a fun little trip to see what it's like, because the trains are way longer and bigger and very different to the standard underground trains. So yeah, I mean, I get excited about trains rather than tunnels. So maybe we'll take a day out together, Vicky. You can read all about Vicky's super fun day down the tunnels on wider.co.uk. In a couple of days, we'll be putting the story up, and there'll be all of Christopher's wonderful pictures, and we shot some video as well. It's going to be super cool, so take a look out for it. Jeremy, something else that we've got some wonderful pictures of, and in the current issue of the magazine, it's an exclusive to us. It's McLaren's new car.
That's right. Now, we like McLaren at Wired. We've been covering them for quite a few years. Not only just their Applied Technologies division, but also what they actually do on the track and what they can put on the road. But in its history, since its launch in 1963, McLaren has actually never replaced an existing car. It's always waited, you know, taken the cars off the road and then produced something else. But this is actually the first time that they've done that. So this is the new 720S, which is the successor to the 650S coupe. Now, the thing is that this car is borrowing. If you remember a few years ago, they brought out the fantastic P1, which was a distillation of their Formula One technology into a hypercar that you could actually buy. Admittedly, you had to be very bloody rich to actually buy it, but, you know, you could actually buy it. Now, a lot of that, the processes and a lot of the special technology that was in the P1 have actually been ported into the 720S. So you've got some, I'll highlight some of the construction innovations, but this, you know, you've got ridiculous figures. You've got 0 to 60 in 2.8 seconds, which is lightning quick. And you've got a top speed of 241 kilometres per hour.
341 kilometres per hour.
That's right. But it's absolutely blisteringly fast. It'll go through petrol very, very quickly. But the point being is that it has a monocoque, a carbon fibre monocoque chassis, which is not new in itself. But what they've done, they've bolted on the top part with the A and B pillars, and this sort of canopy, sort of fighter pilot canopy roof. So the glass itself is the weight-saving glass from the P1. Then you've got this carbon fibre structure on the top of the monocoque. So what you have is an incredibly light, stiff and strong car. And this is a very difficult thing to do.
Oh, come on, Roland.
Look, he's just been saying monocoque.
Oh, my God. Oh, yes. My God.
I mean, come on.
Children.
Okay. There's children.
Child.
Okay. Come on, Jeremy, take it seriously.
Okay. So basically, this is a very, very cool car. The panelling on the side, you'll notice if you take a look at the pictures, our exclusive photo shoot with the car, the panelling on the side is not, you know, shrink-wrapped, as they call it. You know, the panels aren't actually forced into the side of the car. You know, they come out and they allow, they've got holes and channels, so they allow the air to pass through the panels of the car.
Which is quite important when you're going at 341 kilometres an hour.
But the whole point is actually it doesn't try and do all the aerodynamics on the surface of the car. It channels air through the body of the car in order to produce more aerodynamics on that. And even down to the headlight lenses have a T-bar across the front of them with the air channels through those. Huh. So they're trying to make use of all the aerodynamics they possibly can.
So something that really caught my eye in your write-up, which people can read in the magazine, is that it uses algorithms.
So this is what they call the magic carpet ride. Now, what it does, it monitors the speed at which the car is going, and then it decides where to put the oil in the suspension system into different parts of the car, so different parts of the four corners of the car. And it does that on a continual basis, and it takes into account not only the movements of the wheels, what's coming up in front of the car, and also the temperature as well, because temperature will affect how quickly the oil is allowed to be pushed from one part of the suspension system to the other.
And it's doing this in the blink of an eye.
It's doing this on the fly, rather than trying to work out, oh, I've just had a bump on this wheel, let's try and stiffen it. It's trying to do it before that actually happens. So what you happen is you get this incredibly smooth ride. Another thing that it actually does, which was very cool, was that it has an adaptive instrument display cluster. So that this instrument, we normally is fixed in a car. You get the speedo and the revometer, that is right there in front of you. However, at the press of a button, and also when you get into the car, this thing slides out of the dashboard and up it comes. So you've got the instruments. And now that's very cool and sci-fi and high-tech, and it's just the sort of thing you want to see when you've spent a ridiculous amount of money on a new McLaren. But if you go to a track and you like your track days, and McLaren drivers do tend to do that, at the press of a button, that instrument cluster goes back down into the dashboard, going down to a horizontal position and slotting into a slot. And then it has a separate thin screen just on the top of what would have been the instrument display, and that only displays your revs and gears and a very limited amount of information. And the idea is that that's all you need in terms of going around the track and no distractions whatsoever. So it's a really cool little extra space age gadget for the car.
There are two things that get Jeremy White excited: giant cream eggs and luxury cars. So the McLaren 720S is available in May from, I think, prices of £207,900.
That's right, yes. If you're worried about the 900, then just don't bother going in.
Well, there you go. We'll leave it there. Oh, no, we won't. We were going to talk about an autonomous tractor as well. Sorry, I forgot. Autonomous tractors, Jeremy.
Well, I love autonomous vehicles. We write a lot about autonomous cars on Wired.
And I love tractors.
Yeah, and you love tractors.
And together we are...
Don't sing.
Tractor and robot. Coming to a small theatre near you. But basically, this is something that I've stumbled across, one of those beautiful things you stumble across on the internet research. And what not only are you used to seeing autonomous cars in the magazine and online as well, but this is actually an autonomous tractor. Now, it's been built by Case, and it's based on their existing Case IH Magnum tractor, the Magnum tractor.
But, of course.
Yeah, but it uses all of the existing technology for autonomous vehicles that we have now. So it's powered mainly by LiDAR, light radar. And that, so it allows it to, you can plan it to go through a field in certain patterns. It can take account of obstacles in its way and go around them. It can work in tandem with other autonomous tractors, so you can set them to work out the most efficient way of going around the fields. The farmer can be sitting in their farm house and monitoring the progress from a smart device or something like that. Basically they'll be able to do whatever a normal tractor can do and work in tandem with other autonomous vehicles.
And it's just a concept for now.
Yeah.
But to give people an idea of what it looks like if they don't have Google in front of them or whatever, it looks a bit like a Formula One car that someone put the wrong wheels on.
That's right. I mean, that's the thing. We send off our photographers to go and take these images. And you cross your fingers. You go like, this is a really cool thing. Please, please make it look as cool as it actually is. This thing has come back.
Nailed it.
And it looks better than I could have ever possibly imagined. It looks like a Formula One car on the page. And so much so that I was arguing to have a big banner splash on the page saying, this is a tractor, because if you're flicking through the mag, you probably won't realise it. You think it's a sports car.
The wheels are the giveaway, but if you don't clock them immediately, then it does. It looks like a sports car. Yeah. I spent a couple of days this week on some farms, as you do, and it was interesting to hear people there talking about the potential impact of autonomous vehicles. It's really difficult to see in the next couple of years full autonomy, level 5 autonomy being introduced onto city streets, but on farms and with vehicles like this, there's a very, very strong possibility that it will, because the only thing that you have to avoid is, well, nothing really.
Well, this would be where the test cases are then. They can do as many tests as they want, but they can really develop technology on these sorts of areas.
Mm. And they're already using very, very advanced technology to perfectly plant seeds on huge, huge farms. So if you were to have a fully autonomous system, then it would bring up that level of accuracy even more, and you'd be able to get better yield from your crop, etc., etc. So there's a lot of excitement for these kind of this kind of technology in the farming industry.
Could get your lettuce a lot quicker.
Yes.
I don't, 17 days.
Without getting into it, that's not what's holding up lettuce delivery.
Oh.
But we'll say.
I want to get into it.
No. No, I spent 2 days hearing about lettuce logistics. I've had enough. We'll leave it there for now. Thank you very much, everyone, for your contributions. And we will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.